I was talking with someone this week about reading the Bible, and one of the things that came up in that conversation is that when it comes to reading the Bible, reading the Old Testament, the first 39 books of the Bible, that can be really difficult to jump into the Old Testament. Some parts are easier than others, but it can be really difficult to jump in and read it and make sense of it. And there's a couple reasons for this. One reason is because the Old Testament mentions all kinds of people and all kinds of places that don't have a place in our world today. And so you'll hear about the Edomites, and you'll hear about the Ephraimites, and you'll hear about the Assyrians, and you'll hear about the Babylonians, and you're like, who are those people in the world today? Those people, they don't have a place in the world today anymore. Those kingdoms are no more. You'll hear about places like Assyria or Babylon. Well, where is that? Oh, well, that's modern day Iraq, or that's modern day Iran, or Ephesus. Oh, well, that's modern day Turkey. It's like those places aren't even places anymore. They have new names and new boundaries. And so reading that, it can be difficult. Like, what world is this? It feels like a different world. Another reason why reading the Old Testament can seem difficult is because of Judaism. Expressed in the Old Testament, we see that there are laws that are to be followed. So if you have on the roof of your house, there's a deck basically on top of your house, and you need to make sure that you have a fence around your deck roof so that no one falls off, because if they do and you didn't, it's negligence and you're not loving your neighbor. And so there's laws about stuff like this, and you're like, what? I mean, I've got an asphalt shingle roof. This makes no sense to me. Or there's laws about sacrifices, you know? If this happened to you in the night, now you're unclean, so now you got to go outside the camp for 7 days. But when you come back in, you need 2 turtle doves. And I'm like, are turtle doves even around here? Like, where would I even get one of those? And so, and then there's the temple. There's these things that you're like, I really don't understand them. And people who don't even really understand the Bible might have some kind of sense of like, I think Jesus affects all of that somehow, and it's like it doesn't count anymore or something. I don't know. So I'm kind of reading this and it feels irrelevant and I just get lost. And then another reason why reading the Old Testament can seem really difficult is it can be difficult to find us in the Old Testament. So we're reading about Israel and we're like, okay, so who's Israel? Is the United States Israel? No, the United States is no. Okay, well, is the church Israel? Well, yes and no, because in Israel, in the Bible, in the Old Testament, some of those people were God's people, like God's elect, but some of them weren't. And in the church, only God's elect are in the church, the real church. So is it? No, that's too confusing. So where are we? How am I supposed to interpret? Is this my nation? Is this my church? Is this my family? Like, how do I find me in the Old Testament? And it can be very confusing. And because of that, some people just stick to the New Testament. But if you've ever had a sense that the world around you is broken, and you've wondered, how can God be awesome and powerful and righteous, this righteous being, this perfect being, and things be going so badly in the world around us at the same time? How can these two things both be true? God is so great and so good, and the world is so bad, and things are so messed up. And if you've ever been perplexed about this and tried to make it fit together and not been able to really do that, then I would suggest that the Old Testament is of great relevance to you. And I would even suggest that the book of Habakkuk is of great relevance. The book of Habakkuk is a short book, 3 chapters. It's near the end of the Old Testament. It's one of the minor prophets. There's 12 shorter books toward the end that are referred to as the minor prophets because they're shorter in length. And that's what we've been preaching through on Sundays here at First Baptist, just working through those 12 minor prophets. And that's where we're at today. And so if you have a Bible, go ahead and turn over to Habakkuk. We're not going to read all three chapters, but we're going to jump around and hit some of the high points. And we're going to be looking primarily at this idea of how can God be so great and good and the world be so bad? How can both of these things be true? How can we make sense of this, rectify it, and make it fit somehow wrap our mind around it? So if you will turn to the book of Habakkuk, we're going to jump in chapter 1, and we're going to read verses 2 through 4. The prophet Habakkuk says, "O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, and you will not hear, or cry to you violence, and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity, and why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed, and justice goes forth and never goes forth, for the wicked surround the righteous. So justice goes forth perverted." So the book of Habakkuk opens up with Habakkuk basically complaining to God. As a matter of fact, your Bible might even have a heading that says Habakkuk's complaint. And I often tell my kids, stop complaining. If you have kids, that might have come out of your mouth at some point. Stop complaining. And I will say, you remember how the Israelites complained that they wanted meat to eat, and God gave them meat, and then they died, or how snakes came out, and they bit them because they were complaining. The lesson is don't complain. So I teach my kids, don't complain. But there is a difference about complaining against God that has at its heart a sense of a demand, like I deserve entitlement. That's the word I was looking for. A sense of entitlement, I deserve, and that has a sense of God, you're bad because you're not giving me what I think I deserve. That is complaining that is clearly sin. But then there's this other thing that is complaining about sin and about brokenness in the world around us. And another word that the Bible uses for that activity is lament. Lament. So we look at Habakkuk and we see him complaining, but he's actually lamenting. What is Habakkuk lamenting? And these two verses, Habakkuk laments violence and destruction and iniquity and wrong and strife and contention and injustice. Where is all of this coming from? Well, there's two possible sources. One possible source is another nation. He lives in the nation of Judah. There is another nation. We've talked about it actually the past several weeks when Pastor Andrew preached about Jonah. He talked about the city of Nineveh. It's the capital city of Assyria. Then we talked about Assyria again last week. And so Assyria is a nation, and they are bad dudes. They are ruthless and violent, and they have been oppressive against Judah. They wiped out Israel, northern kingdom. They've been oppressive against Judah. And so one source of all of this violence and destruction is this outside nation that's afflicting them. Another source, though, is the people within Judah. You see, the reason that God has allowed Assyria to afflict Habakkuk's people is because of their own sin. And so he could be talking about just the goings-on of life in society around him. That injustice is flourishing, that the wicked surround the righteous, that justice goes forth perverted, that there's bribery and there's all of these things. And it could be a mixture of both. Things are bad from without, and things are bad within. And so he's crying out, God, why do you make me see this? And you just sit by and watch. I'm lamenting it. And he's doing two things in saying this. One, he's acknowledging that God is sovereign. Why do you make me see this. He's saying, God, you could stop this. Everything that's happening is happening on your watch. You are not unaware, and you are not out of control. And the second thing, though, is he is lamenting the fact that God doesn't seem to be doing anything. You're in control and aware. Why aren't you doing something about it? Can you identify with this at all? Have you ever looked at life and you've noticed something that is askew, something that's messed up, and you're like, why is this? Why is this way? It could be one of your own personal struggles. It could be the struggle of someone you love and care about. It could be the struggle of someone that you really struggle to love and care about, but you know about their struggle nonetheless. It could be societally. It could be nationally. It could be internationally. There's something you see. It's broken, and you're like, why is this way? You're saying, God, why do you allow this to happen? Why don't you do something about it? Maybe you've experienced that. Maybe you can identify with those very questions. And if you've ever asked God those questions before, God, why is it this way? And why don't you do something about it? My guess is you didn't get an answer. You didn't hear anything. But maybe the reason why we don't get an answer when we ask those questions is because God has kind of already answered that question for us in what he gives to Habakkuk, in the answer that he gives to Habakkuk. Look with me at verses 5 through 8. God says, look among the nations and see, wonder, and be astounded. For I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than the evening wolves. Their horsemen press proudly on. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle, swift to devour. Now, we're looking for an answer, right? And we read this, and we're like, okay, the Chaldeans. Who are the Chaldeans? Well, the Chaldeans are Babylonians. Well, who are the Babylonians? Well, there are people who don't exist anymore. And you're like, here we go again, talking about people and places that don't exist anymore. I find no answer in this. This is meaningless to me. Well, don't check out. Here's what God is saying. To Habakkuk, God's saying, Habakkuk, you think you know what's going on. You think you know that Assyria is bad and they're giving you guys grief. And you think you know that the people around you are bad and give each other grief. And that I'm not doing anything. But you don't know what I'm doing. Because I've got another nation, Babylon, and they're going to come against the Assyrians. And then they're going to come against your people as well. So Babylon. That's my answer to your prayer. And that, again, probably doesn't mean anything to you. And I don't blame you. But here's what it should mean. These verses. And this is our first point. It should mean that we need to know that God is working. That's basically the answer is Babylon. But the bigger answer is, Habakkuk, you don't know what I'm doing. You see, we lament when we see bad things that don't make sense to us, and we cry out to God about them, and we say, God, why is it this way? And where are you? Why aren't you doing anything about it? But we can't see the bigger picture, and we don't have all the details, and we don't know in what ways God is working behind the scenes. But we need to know that God is working. In John chapter 5, Jesus heals a man. Now, the problem with this is it's on the one day of the week where, at that time, you weren't supposed to be doing any work. And Jesus healing this man on that day was considered by Jesus' critics and opponents work. And Jesus' response to them was not, oh no, guys, it's not work. Healing is in a different category, and so you're just mistaken. He doesn't tell them they're wrong. What he tells them is, my Father, he's talking about God, my Father is working until now, and I am working. That's verse 17 of John chapter 5. My Father is working until now, and I'm working. He's saying, I'm not doing anything different. You're going to fault me? I'm not doing anything different than what God does. And God is always at work, even up to this very moment. God is always at work. God is always up to something. We look at the world and the badness of the world and the brokenness of the world, and it looks like God has checked out, but God is always doing something, even though we're not aware of it. Back in 2012, John Piper tweeted this, and it went off the charts, likes, retweets, shares. He said, every day, in every circumstance, God is always doing 10,000 things in your life. But you might be aware of only three of them. I think three is generous. We might not be aware of any of them, but God is always at work. There's a song that we've sang here. It's been a while since we've sang it. It's an old hymn by William Cowper. It was redone by Sovereign Grace, but it says this. The words are so beautiful. God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Deep in his dark and hidden minds, with never failing skill, he fashions all his bright designs and works his sovereign will. There are a number of things that are going on in the world around us, and maybe in our own lives. And we say, why is this happening? And God, why are you letting it? And why aren't you stopping it? God, don't you care? And we need to know that God is at work. There are things that we don't have the answers to, and frankly, we probably never will. But this we can be sure of. Even when we can't see it, God is always doing something. God is never inactive. Now, this doesn't bring peace and tranquility to Habakkuk. I'm at work, Habakkuk. I'm sending another bad nation to beat up on the bad nation that's beating up on you, but I'm also going to beat up on the bad people who live around you. I'm at work. This doesn't quite set right with Habakkuk. And so in verses 12 through 13, he says, are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them, this is Babylon, as judgment, and you, O rock, have established them for reproof against his own people. But then he says, you who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong. So he's not faulting God, but he's asking this question. Why do you look idly at traitors and are silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? God, you're not bad. You're really good. But why do you just watch bad people do bad things to people who aren't even as bad as they are? He poses this question. You are holy and righteous. How can you let this happen? And to make sense of what he's feeling, I mean, again, the Old Testament can seem far removed. To really like stand in Habakkuk's shoes, just think about our country today. If we went around the room and said, what do you think is wrong with America today? We would get all kinds of different answers. Some of these answers would be based somewhat on political persuasions. I think it's wrong that all of our kids are going to have to wear masks at school. I think it's wrong that parents are upset about their kids wearing masks at school. We would get different answers. We would get stuff like, I think that it's wrong that people can kill a baby in the womb. And we would say, I think it's wrong that a person can shoot another person, and because they wear a badge, they get some kind of identity. And we could go around the room and ask, what's wrong with our nation today? And we would come up with answers. They might be agreeable, they might be disagreeable, but we would all say, regardless of where we stand on various issues, we would all say, things are broken. Things are jacked up. And so what if we say, God, things are broken and things are jacked up. And God said, don't worry about it, guys. I'm going to take care of this. I'm going to send China. Actually, no, I'm going to send North Korea. And they are going to wipe the floor with you guys. And you won't have to worry about any of those things because you will be absolutely decimated and oppressed. You won't have to worry about wearing masks when you're living in concentration camps and starving to death. North Korea is going to come in, and they are just going to flatten you all. Don't worry about it. I've got this. You probably would not think that that's a good solution. You would say, wait a minute, God. I mean, we're jacked up, but they are way more jacked up than us. How are you going to use their way more jacked upness to fix our jacked upness? Like, that does not seem right, God. Well, that's what Habakkuk is feeling right now. How are you going to take people who are way more jacked up than us to come in and punish us, and that's going to fix our jacked up situation? And so Habakkuk says in chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. So Habakkuk has complained to God about this situation, and now he says, I'm going to stand here and wait and see how God answers what I've said. And God says, chapter 2, write the vision, make it plain on tablets, so he may run with it who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him. But my righteous shall live by faith. God essentially tells Habakkuk, who is waiting for God's answer, that Habakkuk, you're going to have to wait longer. You're waiting for an answer, get used to waiting. You're going to wait longer. I am working, but it is in my time. It will come. It will not delay. It's not a lie. It may seem slow, but it will come in the appointed time. God is saying that his timing is not our timing. That he is always on time, but he is on his time, not our time. So because of this waiting, this time that they're going to be waiting, God wants Habakkuk to write down this exchange so people, subsequent people who read it, could know that God is up to something even though they can't see it. And then he says his soul is puffed up. He's talking about the king of Babylon. He's saying, yeah, I know that this dude's bad. And so, again, you could be like, well, if you're acknowledging he's bad, then God, how can you be using this? How could it be possible? And God's response is, but the righteous shall live by faith. And that's our second point. Live by faith. Live by faith. Living by faith means confidently, patiently, but expectantly waiting for an outcome that you cannot see. So God says, you're going to have to wait longer, and I know this dude is a bad dude, but you need to live by faith, Habakkuk. And what are the things that Habakkuk needs to be confidently, patiently, expectantly waiting for, trusting in? Well, the first of those is Babylon's doom. God acknowledged that this guy's puffed up, right? In verse 13 of chapter 2, he says, behold, is it not from the Lord of hosts that peoples labor merely for fire and nations weary themselves for nothing? He's saying, Babylon is going to come. They're going to conquer all these nations. They're going to do all this stuff. And what is it? They're just storing up kindling for fire. I am going to stop them dead in their tracks. All of their works are going to come to nothing. In verse 16, it says, talking about Babylon, you will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show yourself uncircumcision. The cup in the Lord's right hand, will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. So you guys think you're this great mighty nation, but I'm going to judge you. You are going to drink the cup of my judgment. So he's saying, Habakkuk, this nation, they will eventually pay. You've got to know that this is coming. You need to have faith that I will judge the wicked. The second thing is God's triumph. You need to have faith in God's triumph. Verse 14, God says, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. It's a very wordy statement, but as the waters cover the sea, what is it, like 80% of the earth is water or something like that? So a lot of waters. Waters cover the sea. It's a weird thing to say there's a lot of water, but God is saying, the knowledge of my glory is going to be as great around the earth as the waters are around the earth. What does that mean? It means triumph. It means that God will triumph. The knowledge of his glory, his greatness, will ultimately prevail over all else. And then the other thing that they need to have faith in is God's unseen rule, even now. In verse 18 and 19, it talks about those who worship idols. Well, the Babylonians, they worship idols. They're not real gods. But then in verse 20, it says, but the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silent before him. God is ruling even now. He's in his holy temple. He's seated on his throne. Even though you can't see it, the idols, they don't do anything because they're not real. You might think God's not doing anything, but God is seated on his throne. He is ruling even now. Now, this isn't unique to Habakkuk or his people. It's necessary for us to live by faith too. God says in Romans, the righteous shall live by faith. So if we would be righteous, if we would be right with God, we must live by faith as well. And that includes these three things that I've just mentioned. Babylon's doom is an example of the doom of all sinners. Babylon's doom is an example of the doom of all sinners. And God's triumph eventually will come in judgment. The way that God will triumph is by judging all sin and all sinners. And in the cross of Jesus, this is what has happened. God has declared the doom of sinners by judging sin in Jesus and his triumph over sin by punishing sin in Jesus. And so when it says the righteous shall live by faith, what does that mean? It means we must have faith in Jesus. We must believe that God has punished sin in Jesus, that God has triumphed over sin in Jesus, and that includes our sin. And so we must have faith in Jesus. In response to what God is going to do, Habakkuk appeals to God's mercy and God's work of redemption. And we read about this in verses 2 through 16 of chapter 3. And I'm just going to grab some pieces of this. He says, O Lord, I have heard the report of you, and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of years, revive it. In the midst of years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. So he's saying, I've heard of what you've done, and Lord, it makes me fear you. Make it happen again. And here's what he wants God to do again. He says, God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from his hand, and there he veiled his power. Before him went pestilence, and plague followed at his heels. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the nations. Then the eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. I'm going to jump down. Was your wrath against the rivers? Verse 8. O Lord, was your anger against the rivers, or your indignation against the sea when you rode on your horses on your chariot of salvation? As he goes on down, verse 10. The mountains saw you and writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted up its hands on high. And as he's going on, it's using this imagery and this symbolism that kind of goes back to Exodus, the book of Exodus, when God delivered the people of Israel out of slavery in Egypt. He parted seas. He sent plagues against the greatest nation on earth. God descended on Mount Sinai, and there was lightning and smoke and thunder and fire. And you see this bigness of God. So what is What is Habakkuk doing here? He's fleshing out a big view of God. He's fearing God, and that's our third point. Fear God. You see, one of the problems of Christianity today is this phrase, God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. Now, I'm not saying that either part of that statement is a false statement, but it's the way that statement is packaged. It's like middle schoolers. Hey, Sally has a crush on you. She really likes you. Hey, Bobby wants to be your boyfriend. Say yes or no. It's this like, hey, somebody is infatuated with you, and that makes you feel good because it's all about you. I mean, do you really care about Bobby or Sally? Not really. I mean, do they stink? Do they look goofy? Okay, great. They like me. It's all about me. And so we have a type of relationship with God that is, God likes me and it's all about me, and it's very minimal. Minimal commitment, minimal relationship, and it's easy to compartmentalize. It really doesn't make sense when the world is running out of control. But it should make perfect sense if our God is just a God who's infatuated with me, has a minimal relationship, and is easy to compartmentalize in my life. If I can easily pack God away in my life, then why would I expect him to exert influence and control over the entire universe? But what is needed, and what we see Habakkuk doing here, is fleshing out this huge, robust, overwhelming, and authoritative view of God. God, the world doesn't make sense, and what you're doing doesn't make sense, but God, I know you are big and great and powerful. I fear you. I fear you. There's a story written by a man named C.S. Lewis. It's the Chronicles of Narnia. It was a book and a cartoon and a movie. And it's not an allegory. Not everything in the story represents something about Christianity. But there's a lot of symbolism in this story that ties to or points to Christianity. The story's about some children who find a portal, if you will, to another world. It's a world filled with talking animals, and it's a world where a wicked witch is exerting her evil influence, and all that was once flourishing has now grown cold, and the world is essentially frozen. But there is a king who is going to return, and he's going to break the power of this evil witch, and he's going to liberate all those who have been captured and enslaved, and his name is Aslan. And there's a quote from the story that I wanted to share with you today. One of these children is talking to one of the animals, again, talking animals, about Aslan. And the animal says, Aslan is a lion. The lion, the great lion. Ooh, said Susan. I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion. Safe, said Mr. Beaver. Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you. That's what God is like. He comes down and the mountains melt. You're like, God, were you mad at the rivers? That the rivers flee, the Jordan River and the Red Sea, they part, they flee before you. They're scared of you. Of course he's not safe, but he's good. He's good. Lewis is capturing for us a picture of fearing God. We tremble, but not because we're scared, but because he's powerful. But we're not afraid because he's good. And so we need to be reminded about this, and we need to fear God. Habakkuk closes verses 17 through 19 with this. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on high places. To the choir master with stringed instruments. That means this is offered in the form of a song. What Habakkuk describes here in verse 17 is a situation that's pretty much hopeless, where things are not producing, things are not yielding, things are not materializing. And that type of situation, that hopeless situation, would undoubtedly be accompanied by great suffering. And how does Habakkuk say he will respond? With worship and dependency upon God. First church I was on staff at would talk about suffering. And they would talk about worship in the face of suffering. But the idea was that suffering was bad, but you didn't have to suffer. And that what you would do is you would worship through the suffering until you got your deliverance, until you got your healing, until your restoration. And so worship became a means to an end. I do this to make this stop. Because this is, man, we want to do everything we can to protect ourselves from suffering or pain. And so I'm going to pray till I get my healing. I'm going to worship till I get my answer. It's just like I'm going to rub the lucky rabbit's foot just until I can get what I want. Rub that genie's lamp. I'm going to worship and pray till I get my deliverance, my healing, my answer. Second church I was on staff at, I swear, there must have been some kind of planned preaching rotation where like every 5 weeks you had to hear a sermon on suffering. I'm like, what is the deal? This guy talks about suffering all the time. Like I woke up in the morning and I poured my cornflakes and I suffered. Like it's just part of your daily routine, suffering. And yet you worship. But it wasn't you worship to get out of your suffering. It was you worship God in the midst of your suffering. And I'm like, what is the deal? What is the deal with this? Well, let me be clear. It's not wrong or bad to pray for healing or to pray for your circumstances to change. But what if they don't? What if they don't? What if it never stops? You see, in this life, everyone will experience suffering at some point. But not everyone will be healed, delivered, or restored. Some of our suffering will not end until this life ends. And if worship is only a means to an end, and we don't get what we want in this life, then worship doesn't work. But if worship is acknowledging that God is good, and that even in all the badness of this world, that he doesn't change, then worship actually sustains me through my suffering, even if it never ends. So the question is, will we worship God because he's good and because he sustains us and he saves us and is eternally good to us, even in the midst of our suffering? Habakkuk says, God, you're my strength, you're my salvation, even if everything goes to hell in a handbasket, I'm still going to worship you. This world is broken, and it is hard to make sense of. But honestly, there's probably nothing harder to make sense of in all of the world than how or why a holy, perfect God would give up all of the glory and all of the comfort that he has, and would come into our world, into space and time, and would take on flesh, and would live a life of suffering without ever sinning himself, only to go to a cross and experience infinite suffering for people who deserve what he's experiencing while he doesn't. Of all of the broken things in the world that don't make any sense, that's got to be the biggest one. Why would God do that? And the reason is because 3 days later, when Jesus raised from the dead, he offered pardon. He offered forgiveness because God is merciful. And that mercy that we have through Jesus is the ultimate source of hope. When this world, we look at it, it's broken, it doesn't make sense, we wonder what's up. We do all those things, we live by faith, we fear God, yes, but we look to the hope that we have in Jesus. God has dealt with all the brokenness of the world in Jesus, and that's our source of hope. I'm going to invite our musicians to go ahead and come back to the stage, and we're all going to go ahead and stand. I'm going to pray with us before we sing. Regardless of what's going on in your life today, you have the choice to find hope in God and to worship, to try to use worship to get something from God, or to just live life dumbfounded and perplexed and ignore the greater reality of God in the midst of all.